The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from theteenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com. Wicked for Good star Marissa Bode says casting disabled actors makes an important statement. This article was written by Honestine Fraser on November 13th. For Wicked for Good star Marissa Bode, the past year has been quite a whirlwind. Shortly after graduating from college, the 25-year-old landed her first major role as Nessa Rose Throp in the film adaptation of Wicked, joining a stacked cast of veteran actors, including Ariana Grande, Cynthia Erivo, and Jonathan Bailey. It's not a bad way to start your career, although she says it did feel overwhelming to be thrust into one of the most notable press tours for a blockbuster film in recent memory. Our first stop on the press tour was Australia last year, and right before I went out onto the yellow brick road carpet they had, I remember feeling like, oh my God, I feel sick, she tells Teen Vogue. I was so anxious, incredibly anxious, because there's so many people there. But, Bode continues, I think getting through that first stop with all those people made it easier to do the rest of everything, and all the fans were nothing but lovely. Bode's involvement in the film adaptation of Wicked is significant. She's the first queer woman of color to take on the role of Nessa Rose, and she's the first wheelchair user to play the role, even though that is a major detail of Nessa's character. I'm really glad that Wicked has given me the chance to amplify more disabled voices with the platform I have and encourage others to not only speak out, but to my non-disabled peers to also help us out, because we can't do it on our own, Bode says. The disabled community, unfortunately, is one of those communities that is often left behind or left out of the conversation completely when it comes to fighting for our rights. Next, Marissa Bode speaks with us for Teen Vogue's New Hollywood Class of 2025. This interview has been edited and condensed for clarity. Teen Vogue, TV. Let's talk about your career journey. What drew you to performing arts? Marissa Bode, MB. I started acting, truly, just for fun in the local community theater in Wisconsin growing up. By the end of high school, it just grew into something that I was fascinated by in terms of the subtleties of on-camera acting specifically. I went to a performing arts college, and I continued to audition my first year after graduating. Then, almost a year after graduating, I booked Wicked. In between everything, I had booked maybe one or two commercials, but nothing big like Wicked, so it seemed to happen oddly fast for me. I, of course, am so grateful for this career path so far. TV. Are there any moments when you've questioned the career path you were on? Or did you always know this was something you were going to do? MB. After graduating, I think a lot of people go through this period, especially when it's so hard to find work to stay alive, a survival job, and balancing acting at the same time. And as a disabled person specifically, it was so hard to find any sort of survival job out of college where people didn't just look at me and make a million assumptions, even if I was qualified for the position. It was frustrating. So I ended up not disclosing that I was disabled, and the second I did that, I heard back from so many jobs, which was really frustrating. But I think I did question if acting was something I financially could continue to do. Not because I didn't love it, but because I needed to eat and to live and to keep paying rent and whatever else. I don't think anybody should have to choose between their passion and eating and living, and I think that goes for, really, any job in general. But I've learned a lot from that, and it has humbled me in a lot of ways. TV. Based on the Broadway show, we know that Nessa Rose has a larger role in Wicked for Good as the Wicked Witch of the East. Was the preparation for the second film a little different than the first film? What did you do to get ready for this new side of her character? MB. The preparation was very different for me because she definitely switches. It's less happy-go-lucky, definitely a lot less hopeful than Nessa in the first film. It goes back to that thing of wanting control, not necessarily always of others, but of her own life and herself. I think it's twice as hard when she did grow up so coddled, something that she didn't ask for. Nessa doesn't make the best decisions, and she is very selfish. But I understand where she's coming from. When the one person that's left, or that you feel is left, who you love and care for so deeply, doesn't feel the same. I understand how painful that is, and just the disabled experience of, I've experienced it before in my life, and I know disabled peers in my life who have experienced having people be nice to you from a distance, but it's not always genuine. A lot of the time, it's self-righteous, rather than actually caring about my personhood, or fully seeing me as a person. So, I really do understand Nessa in so many different ways, and I really do love the complexities and the many layers to her. TV. Is there a particular scene that you most loved shooting for part two? MB. I can say this, 'cause you see it for a second in the trailer, probably being on wires yet again, in the air filming. Yeah, as I float in the air. TV. Did you have to train or prepare for that at all? MB. A little bit. Of course, we wanted to make sure that everything is safe. Previously, in a different space, we had practiced just being on wires and being in the air, both in my chair, because of the first film where I fly with my chair, and then the second film, out of my chair. Obviously, practicing just me floating for the second part. TV. The slippers in the subplot of the original musical were criticized as being disrespectful to the disabled community because Nessa Rose has the ability to walk with them after Elphaba bewitches them. You've said in the past that there are some changes that make the plot less harmful toward the disabled community. Without spoiling too much, can you share how the character or the subplot was made a little less ableist? MB. I think it comes down to the writing. The writing was done before I had been cast, so I personally didn't have a hand on the writing itself, but I really appreciated it. After talking with Winnie, one of the main writers of Wicked, she spoke about talking with a disabled friend on how to make those changes after hearing some of the feedback from the disabled community of the stage musical, of how it is a bit harmful. And know that the motivation behind Nessa is definitely different in the second film, from wanting to be and begging to be healed and fixed from Elphaba. Her desires are a lot different, which I think adds to her as a character. 'Cause I think when it comes to disabled characters, that being their only desire or the only thing they're focused on tends to make them a lot more one-dimensional. TV. Can you reflect a bit on why it's important to you that you're a part of a representative change like this in the Wicked storytelling universe? MB. Whether it was me who was cast, or anybody who is authentically disabled, I think it's important to cast disabled people as disabled characters, because we go about life that way, and no one knows better than us. But also, in an industry where disabled people already aren't cast a ton, it makes a statement to cast somebody who is authentically disabled in the role, and gives more opportunity to those that are still fighting to be seen in the industry as a whole. So I'm very grateful to be part of this production, something so big, something so beloved. Being a part of something so big and making an effort to cast somebody who is disabled is incredibly important, and hopefully should send the message to casting directors in the future as well. 1. Cast more disabled people authentically. 2. Just cast more disabled people, period. TV. What have you learned about yourself as both a person and a performer through your work, especially within Wicked? MB. Well, I think for the second act, I did realize how much more of a method actor I am than maybe I thought. Not in the way that was evil to everybody. But prior to when we filmed, or the week before we filmed, I told people that I was going to be around, like, hey, I'm just not going to be as talkative. I'll probably spend more time by myself and in my tent by myself. I probably won't socialize much this week. But if I seem a little off, I swear it's not you. I just want to be more to myself and keep my concentration. I didn't realize how much I really did need that. TV. Is there an ideal role that you would love to play? Anyone you'd like to work with in the future? MB. There's never really been a specific one person. I would love to do more coming-of-age stuff. I think that'd be fun. Or horror, or just queer stuff. In general, I'd love to be involved in more queer projects. Also, I lied. There are several people now that I'm thinking of that I would love to work with. Actually, there's so many. Why did I say none? It just came to my brain. I would love to work with Quinta Brunson. I think she's very talented. I love Abbott Elementary. It's such a fun show. Ayo Edebiri is just a powerhouse that I think I'd love to work with. And then recently, I watched the show Overcompensating, which I really loved. Just right up my alley of coming of age, very fun, also obviously queer. So, Benito Skinner. Our next article from theteenmagazine.com. No Kid is a Bad Kid. What happens to teens in juvie? This article was written by Sarah Marin on October 19th. When people hear of a teen being incarcerated, most of them tend to have the same judgmental reaction. A stolen item becomes proof of privilege and entitlement. A fight turns a struggling teen into a monster. Drug involvement is dismissed as just another consequence of poor choices. Adults often admit that their kid would never do such a thing. What people never consider is that every teenager who gets sent to juvie probably acted that way not because they are bad kids, but as a cry for help, as an act of survival. Before juvie. Reasons for being sent to juvie vary from theft and vandalism, to drug and alcohol offenses, to endangering acts for themselves or others. Let me go deeper into each one of them and the most common reason behind the act. Theft and vandalism mostly happen in groups of more teenagers. Put under a lot of peer pressure, the one kid who so desperately wants to fit in will do mostly anything asked of him. In a circumstance of adrenaline, pressure, shouting, and mostly a lot of insecurity on his side, the one teenager who will do the act will also be punished according to the law. Drug and alcohol offenses. Here are two categories of teenagers. The ones who come from households where the parents are some sort of addicts, or even, as the sad reality shows, they are the ones delivering, dealing, or buying the substances for their parents. The other ones seek comfort in the temporary ecstasy of the substances or alcohol. Never having experienced a loving, comforting, secure environment, teenagers are desperate to crave a warm emotion, hence the offenses. Endangering others or even themselves, a cry for help as it is, analyzing it further, we can certainly tell that teenagers have entered the self-defense mode, where they perceive everyone, including themselves, as a threat or danger. The environment in which a child is raised plays a crucial role in their development. Children from disadvantaged backgrounds, facing poverty, familial instability, or even community violence, are prone to engaging in behaviors that bring them in contact with the justice system. These circumstances, however, don't define a child's character, but highlight the need for support. My point here, no kid is a bad kid. No kid is a dangerous kid. But some kids are hurting, and instead of getting healed, they get sent to juvie. During juvie, every institution has its own policy according to the state it's located in and the laws. While most of them do provide teenagers with psychological assistance, it mostly isn't about understanding the internal, emotional struggles of the teens, but more about control. But here's the catch. Settling a crisis a teenager is going through will not only amplify it, but also lead to new emotional struggles the teens have to deal with alone. The environment is also negatively affecting teens in juvie. Being isolated, having a very strict program, rules, and punishments subjects teens to an abnormal amount of pressure and trauma. Having little to no contact with their loved ones, parents, siblings, closest friends, they might lose the one thing that had kept them above water for a long time. Pictures and memories alone are a more depressing factor than anyone could ever imagine, as teens feel the loss of everything they once had and have no one to talk about it. It may be the law to punish those who commit a crime. In the context of today's modern world, however, where teenagers are subjected to an incredible amount of pressure and stress, both virtual and personal, their mental health is at risk of giving up the constant fight with insecurities, bottled feelings, and unspoken emotions. Isolating them in a cold, lonely place will only make everything worse. Still, there's another side to this reality. While many teens in juvenile facilities are there because of underlying pain or neglect, some do commit acts that endanger others or themselves. Recognizing this complexity doesn't mean abandoning empathy. It means understanding that rehabilitation must balance compassion with responsibility. Such a system should protect society and those involved, while also helping teens heal from what caused the dangerous behavior in the first place. After juvie. The vast majority of teens who get out of juvie show signs of PTSD, anxiety, and depression, starting with crippling mental health, which has been subjected to unimaginable trauma during juvie. These teenagers go back to the very same place that had initially led them to such a low point in their lives, where breaking the law was the only cry for help they could think of. And the circle starts anew. No one around, alone in fear and struggles, no help whatsoever. It's time for us, as a community, as politicians who enforce the laws, to make a change. Raise awareness about the teenager's mental health and provide all the help possible. And the next time we hear of a teen being sent to juvie, we must change the way we view things and know that with enough love and support, they could be just like our kids. No kid is a bad kid. No kid is a dangerous kid. But some kids are hurting, and we must heal them. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Jennifer Lopez opened up about Emmy Muniz's college plans. This article was written by Sarah Delgado on October 29th. Jennifer Lopez and Emmy Muniz are practically glued at the hip. The mother-child duo are spotted enjoying time together on the regular. But that's about to change real soon because, as confirmed by J-Lo herself, Muniz is off to college soon with their twin, Max Muniz. During a recent appearance on Live with Kelly and Mark, Jennifer Lopez opened up about how much the twins, who are now 17, have grown and revealed they are now officially looking at colleges for next year. "We're visiting a college today," Lopez revealed during her Kiss of the Spider-Woman promo trip to New York City. "It's happening. They're leaving. They're going." Lopez continued saying that witnessing this transition period for the twins is exciting for her as a mother. However, she's already feeling like she'll be a little lonely without them. "I'm happy because I remember how exciting that time of my life was when I was like, oh, I'm figuring out what I want to do with my life," she said. "It's an exciting adventure, and I want that for them. But I also think, oh, I'm going to be by myself." The star also added that while she can't wait to see the twins spread their wings, her priority has been creating a cozy nest they can always return to. "Since they were born, I was like, whatever this is, whatever we create, the three of us together, it's going to be something that they always are like, when I go home, it feels good. It smells like home. It tastes like home. All of it," she said. "I always concentrated on that with them, and I feel like we've created that." Lopez added, "They are 17. They'll be 18 in February. They are graduating this June from high school, and I feel like we are a close-knit three now. A lot has happened with us, and we had to bond together." While she didn't share what the twins intend to study, we have an inkling that Emmy Muniz will likely gravitate towards art. Not only did they seemingly visit colleges in the city, which is notoriously home to prestigious art programs from the likes of NYU Tisch and Juilliard, but Lopez also recently revealed she has a musical theater kid to CBS's Sunday Morning. "They go away for camp for musical theater, and they do all the shows, and I get to go see them, and it's fantastic," she added. " Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Joseph Quinn's Eddie Munson won't be in Stranger Things 5, Duffer Brothers confirm. This article was written by Sarah Delgado on October 21st. Stranger Things Season 5 is officially around the corner, and we finally have word from the Duffer Brothers on whether or not Joseph Quinn's Eddie Munson will be back for the series' explosive final season. To rewind a little, Joseph Quinn joined the cast of Stranger Things for Season 4, which premiered in 2022, and immediately became a fan favorite for his portrayal of the D&D and metal connoisseur Eddie Munson. However, fans were left shocked when Eddie met his ultimate demise in Episode 9 of Season 4, sacrificing himself to save his friends and his town. Or did he? Though Eddie's fate seemed pretty clear on screen, Quinn kept teasing fans about Eddie's potential return for years after Season 4's premiere. But don't get your hopes up. Eddie is indeed dead, and the Duffer Brothers have double confirmed just so. In an interview with Empire, published on October 20th, 2025, the Duffer Brothers, a.k.a. the creators and showrunners of Stranger Things, shut down the rumors started by Quinn to confirm Eddie sadly won't return for the show's final season. "I love that Joe Quinn is toying with people, but no, he's dead," Matt Duffer clarified. "Joe is so busy anyway that everyone should know he's not coming back. He's shot like 5 movies since. When the hell has he got time to come and shoot Stranger Things? No, sadly, R.I.P., he's fully under that ground." Quinn has indeed kept booked and busy since he appeared in Stranger Things. You might have noticed him already in Gladiator 2, The Fantastic Four, First Steps, Warfare, and more. And he'll also be portraying George Harrison in Sam Mendes's Beatles biopic. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.